Good evening and welcome to this special collaboration between the Commonwealth Club of California and KQED. This program is the third of a four-part series about President Trump's first 100 days. I'm Brian Watt, morning news anchor for KQED. I'm very excited to be here in San Francisco with a great bipartisan panel. On my far right, Sam Liccardo, mayor of San Jose. He was elected in November of 2014. And Mayor Liccardo has been working on growing every part of San Jose, from creating after-school programs for hundreds of low-income children to overseeing a major expansion of tech employers. Next to him is Corey Shockey, research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, an expert in foreign policy and national security. Corey also worked on the McCain-Palin campaign back in 2008 as a senior policy advisor. Next to Corey. Wait a minute. Well, next to Corey is Jane Kemp. Next to Corey is Jane Kemp, San Francisco supervisor for the 6th District. As part of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors Progressive Wing, Supervisor Kim has been a longtime advocate of issues including affordable housing and access to education. Jane is also the first Korean-American elected official in San Francisco. Yay. Next to me. is Harmeet Dhillon, RNC National Committee Woman for California. Harmeet helped shape the Republican Party's platform as one of California's three members of the RNC. She made headlines in July by opening the second night of the Republican National Convention with a sick prayer. She's also a lawyer and rumored to be a candidate for the role of Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights under U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So, thank you all very much for coming to speak about President Trump's first 100 days. So I'll start with this. I saw a tweet this afternoon from Peter Alexander, not who you think of, I saw. Peter Alexander of NBC News, a correspondent, quoting President Trump on Air Force One. He said, quote, "I think we've had one of the most successful 13 weeks in the history of the presidency." So I'm sure on my panel I have a range of reactions to that statement. But my first question to each of you is, in his first 76 days as president, what do you think President Trump has learned about his new job and workplace? I asked Corey Shockey to start because she's got expertise in some things that are burning right this minute.
So for those of you who are already in your seats and didn't see that the United States just launched 70 cruise missiles at air bases in Syria, President Trump has retaliated against the Assad government for the chemical weapons attack carried out a couple of days ago, which is a policy change of about 180 degrees from where President Trump was before, which was supporting the continuation of President Assad in power in Syria. There are a lot of questions coming out about what's happening, whether these are limited strikes or start of a greater involvement in the war. But they connect to my answer to your question, Brian, which is that I think on foreign and defense policy, the president made very good choices for his cabinet appointments, but has not facilitated lower-level appointments into the departments. So the cabinet secretaries are acting largely without the kinds of supporting staff that one would want in place for this, which prejudices the Pentagon because the active duty military and the civil servants in the Pentagon are such a strong coterie. I don't, however, think President Trump has fared particularly well on foreign policy in his first 100 days, because as the flip in the last 24 hours suggests, the president has a tendency towards indiscipline and erratic behavior, and that's actually not a great thing in American foreign policy. It makes it hard for our allies and supporters to coordinate their activity in a way that support and reinforce what we're doing. And it makes it much more difficult for the people we are trying to deter to understand what we mean. And so I think the Syria example is going to be a very difficult one for America's friends to figure out, does this mean we still want Bashar al-Assad in power, which is a central tenet of the administration's long-term plan for Syria, or does this mean we no longer want Bashar al-Assad in power? I personally guess that they will want to leave him in power but tightly constrain his behavior. But nobody knows at this point. The president's actually not saying, which is another thing they're doing poorly on foreign policy. Mm.
Harmeet Dhillon, what has the president learned in his first 76 days on the job?
Well, he's probably learned that running the country is a very different endeavor than running a large corporation where if you're the owner and you're the boss, what you say goes. And in D.C., not only is that not the case with our balance of power among the different branches of the government, but on top of that, even the branches of government, the branch of government that the president controls is, let's just say the swamp is strong. It's been very difficult for the president to get his arms around some of these agencies. You mentioned the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice is absolutely ridden with career bureaucrats whose agendas are antithetical to what the president wants to accomplish. And so it's not going to be easy to steer the ship of state the way that he would like. And he is also learning the lesson that even dealing with his own party in Congress, as we can see from last week's failure on the Affordable Care Act reform, that they are each their own little princelings with their own demands and their own constituencies as well. You can't just have Steve Bannon call a meeting and tell them how they're going to vote. That did not go very well. So I think he's learning these lessons. And I would say the third example being the courts. You would think you got a bunch of very smart lawyers there in the White House advising him, and they drafted an executive order that tracks designation of state sponsors of terrorism that President Obama identified. And yet, various courts have held that the order is unconstitutional. And so he is finding that it's going to take some skill and diplomacy to deal with the government that he's the head of.
Mm. Go ahead.
I agree with many of the observations that have been made. You know, bluntly, not just in foreign policy, but domestically, I've seen better organized riots over the last 76 days. I mean, this has been a real mess. And I hope that what the president is learning is that in order to govern effectively, particularly to bring together a legislative coalition, you need to be able to govern from the middle. And that means reaching across the other side of the aisle to find folks who are interested in a particular issue. And that is what I'm hearing is happening now on the tax policy that did not happen, certainly with the Affordable Care Act. That would be a hopeful pivot, I think, to many of us who have been waiting for the president to start to see how some kind of policy could be fashioned in the middle and not simply appealing to an extreme.
Mm. Jane Kim.
My response is similar to Harmeet's, and what I believe the president has been learning over the last 78 days is actually very similar to what I believe the people of this country are also learning over the last 78 days, which is, Corey and I were talking about this before we walked into the panel, but there is an incredibly renewed interest amongst the American people in the U.S. government and what the U.S. government does. And for those of you that are Democrats and liberals in the room, in some ways that is a strange silver lining to the Trump administration. I have never gotten so many questions on what it is that the president actually does. How does he impact the everyday lives of San Franciscans? And what is it that the legislative branch, judicial branch, the role of the media, the bureaucracy in making our country and democracy work? And so in some ways it feels like we're back to U.S. government 101, which I think is actually a very good thing. And on a local level, and I represent the Board of Supervisors here in San Francisco, I've had a renewed interest on the impact of the federal government here in the city and county of San Francisco. What percentage of our budget comes from federal funding? You know, as Trump threatens to cut funding from quote-unquote sanctuary cities and states, we really looked and examined, well, what is it that we depend on the federal government for? You know, out of our slightly over $8 billion budget here in the city, $1.2 billion comes either directly from the federal government or through pass-throughs through the state. And of this $1.2 billion, actually, $1 billion is entitlements. Of that, $800 million is health care. And so the repeal of the Affordable Care Act would have had a tremendous impact here in the city for the thousands of San Franciscans that now have access to health care because of the Affordable Care Act. Of course, for the 4.6 million Californians that have also enrolled through the Affordable Care Act. But then you also start to notice, well, where is the federal government not really playing a role? One, which was quite stark for me, is housing. This is an issue that San Franciscans talk about on almost a daily basis. It is a huge crisis, not just in the city, but in this region. And the federal government plays a very small role in the production of housing. But that wasn't always the case. In fact, when we're having debates about Ben Carson and whether he was qualified for HUD, you know, part of me just threw up my hands and said, well, what does HUD really do anymore? In 1940, the U.S. government actually decided to invest greatly in housing because of the Great Depression and the growing wealth and income gap. And here in San Francisco, in the first 30 years, they built about 3,700 units of public housing between 1940 and 1970. In 1970, that decade brought the highest level of federal investment in public housing. We built about 2,100 units in just 10 years. Since 1980, since President Reagan and all preceding presidents, Republican and Democrat, we've seen an incredible divestment in public housing and affordable housing. We've built a paltry 1,000 units in over the last 40 years. And so in many ways, you know, the question that I bring up now is, you know, the role of government, but, you know, the expectations that we have and what their impacts are on the local level.
So I'll follow up quickly there and ask you if any of the early signs from housing and urban development give you hope that there could be more investment at the federal level quickly.
Well, that's not what we're seeing today, and certainly in Trump's skinny budget, you know, he's proposed to completely eliminate CDBG, which is a community development block grant that comes into our city, and that's about $16.5 million to the city and county of San Francisco that helps our most vulnerable communities. So there's a continued departure away, I think, from helping those that are the most vulnerable here in cities and in countries. And by the way, you know, the divestment from HUD in the 1980s and onward happened to dovetail almost directly with the rise of homelessness as an urban phenomenon in cities across the country. San Francisco, San Jose, New York City, Honolulu. There's almost a direct correlation between the divestment in federal investment in housing and the increase of our homeless population over the last 40 years. And so when people say the solution to homelessness is housing, they are absolutely correct. And I think that in times like this of incredible instability and concern and anxiety, it is a good point in time for us to really push our federal representatives to care and invest in the issues that are actually the things that everyday people are concerned with.
Let me get back to the news of today. This was one of those days that we're having to get used to in today's world order where lots of things happen. You know, you wake up or show up to work and find out that Chairman Nunes has stepped aside from the intelligence investigation. But one of the last things we found out before the airstrikes was the nuclear option in the Senate for Neil Gorsuch. We have three lawyers on this panel, and you don't have to be a lawyer to get in on this. But we also have someone who actually clerked in the U.S. Fourth Circuit, right, Harmeet Dhillon. I want to know what you think the Republicans turning to the nuclear option in the Senate, what impact that's going to have on the Supreme Court going forward and even the lower courts.
Well, first of all, I think Neil Gorsuch is a tremendously qualified judge, now soon to be Justice Gorsuch. In terms of the nuclear option, what we're really talking about is a tradition in the Senate that Harry Reid attacked when he eliminated the filibuster for every position other than the Supreme Court. And he decided to take that rather radical step only a few years ago. And this is the end point of that change that he initiated. And so I am not crying too many tears for the nuclear option being exercised. It seems silly to me that in a body where you can pass a decision with 51 votes, that it takes 60 votes to decide to have that vote. So I think it's fine to eliminate it. I think we ought to be looking at elimination of some of the other archaic rules of the Senate as well. The fact is that the people voted, the majority should rule, and this is the net result of President Trump winning the election and getting to pick who's on the Supreme Court. I will also point out that when Democrats have nominated, President Obama nominated very liberal justices, Republicans held votes, and many Republicans voted for President Obama's liberal choices because they believe that the president gets to pick who's on the Supreme Court. That's the rule. The other rule that we are talking about today is the rule that Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden brought into play, which is that in the final year of a presidency and he's termed out and there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court, that we wait until the new president comes into power to vote. And so that's another Democrat rule that people are now regretting. So I'm very happy today. And frankly, a lot of Republicans who have questions about the guidance that we have seen from the from what we've seen in the first 75 days of President Trump, I think Republicans are universally happy with this decision. And a lot of people would say, if this is all he did, you know, we can go home happy.
Sam Liccardo, you're also a lawyer.
Yeah, I think both parties are wrong on this. I think Merrick Garland should have been granted a hearing and should have been confirmed. He was certainly qualified to serve. I think Gorsuch is also qualified to serve. I don't agree with many of his holdings, but nonetheless, he's qualified and he should be voted up or down, and I would imagine would be approved, of course. So I regret that the divisiveness of Washington has come to this. It was not always this way. And I think that, frankly, Democrats should approve him if they believe he's qualified, and I think he is.
Corey, you're not the lawyer, but we'd certainly like for you to weigh in if you'd like to.
It is not my field, but I would say there's a very good book on the politicization of Supreme Court confirmation hearings by Ben Wittes, the founder of the Lawfare blog, that is a history of the politicization, which, crazily enough, starts with Ted Kennedy.
Jen Kim.
You know, I would disagree with Mayor Liccardo. I think Gorsuch is a qualified candidate. I don't have a problem with Trump appointing him or the Senate confirming him. What I have issue with is the statement that Harmeet made, which is that the president gets to pick the U.S. Supreme Court justice, and that was simply not followed last year. President Obama did make a pick when the opening happened, and if Scalia had vacated his position this year, then we should respect President Trump's ability to nominate and Senate to confirm. And I actually think Gorsuch is again a qualified candidate. I think but for the Garland situation last year, we wouldn't see kind of the devolving unfortunate bipartisanship that we're seeing in Congress now. And it's been a long time coming. I think Democrats and Republicans are both to blame for that. But it's certainly, we cannot bring up Gorsuch and the Democratic actions on that without bringing up the Republicans' actions and statements on Garland last year.
Back to your field of expertise, Corey. I wanted to ask you about the departure of Bannon from this level of the National Security Council. You have been very open in your criticism of how the Trump administration is doing its foreign policy, but do you feel like this latest shakeup, which may in fact still be going on, is an indication that they're getting a little bit closer to getting it right?
Yeah, I think the executive order that the president signed 2 days ago fixes a problem that the president created with a very sloppily drafted executive order on the structure of the National Security Staff. And it looks to me like it really just was sloppiness. It wasn't malevolence. That the president himself said he wasn't aware that he was making a change by putting his political advisor, Steve Bannon, on the National Security Council. He also didn't realize that the language that would have removed the director of Central Intelligence and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from the NSC was actually identical to the language that President George W. Bush signed into law in 2001. It was only afterwards that was changed. So I actually think they didn't realize what they were doing, and the new executive order corrects it. but I wouldn't put too much faith in the organizational chart of the White House as a way to control political influence, because I actually think the problem people should be concerned about is not whether Steve Bannon is in NSC meetings, because he still has the ability to advise the president, and that's his job. And now he will be doing it without benefit of hearing the arguments of the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of the Treasury. So we could actually end up in a worse position by something that is a structural fix to a problem.
Harmeet, you're nodding your
head.
Yeah,
I would agree. I think people have a silly obsession with who's on some committee or not as a proxy for whether they like that person as an advisor or not, and all the baggage that's projected onto that person and that advisor. So I think this is a cosmetic change. It's a power struggle of personalities inside the White House, possibly, or possibly it's just what the White House explanation is. I don't know, but I don't think it makes a difference, frankly. I think that the president has a number of advisors in the White House who are going to give him advice, and whether they're sitting in one room or the other is not really relevant.
The one place where it does matter is in public perception of whether the president is making national security decisions for national security or politically gaming it. When I was in the Bush White House from 2001 to 2005, the president was very careful never to permit political advisors in national security meetings because he did not want to create the perception that he was politicizing things about the security of the country. President Obama began allowing political advisors into the national security meetings, and President Trump has just continued that process.
Right. I mean, I would just say it's naive to think that political considerations don't influence the president's foreign policy decisions.
Looking like a committee woman, right? Mayor Liccardo, Sam.
Sure, either works.
Okay, good. Yeah. Everyone
My
else
mom
said
calls it. Me Sam.
Good,
yeah.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, as a mayor who has a lot going on in his city that could really use a blessing from the president, what it is like to make asks to an administration that you largely disagree with.
You know, I think that mayors of large cities throughout the country have generally become accustomed to going it alone for quite a while. Republican and Democratic administrations, it doesn't really matter. The reality is, I think as Supervisor Kim described, as you think about, one of the most impactful programs for cities, not just CDBG, but HOME and a whole host of other HUD programs, really in many ways the federal government has gradually sort of abdicated its responsibility for urban policy over the last 40 years. And so mayors have simply gotten used to it. And we figure out how to govern without a lot of federal help. In the city of San Jose, we don't rely enormously on federal money. We did get some FEMA assistance because of a recent flood. We have, although we certainly have policies in our city that perhaps the immigration authorities in Washington, D.C. don't agree with, there's really not that much money at stake for us because the amount of grant money we get for law enforcement is less than, I think it'll be a little less than $1 million this year in a general fund budget of about $1 billion. So we figure it out on our own. And it won't be any different with this administration. We certainly have seen already that we are concerned about the extent to which politics may be played in the distribution of dollars with the recent decision to defer the full funding grant agreement on a Caltrain electrification. That was a $647 million grant that I think everyone had assumed would go through based on all of the objective merits of the project for many years. And, I hope that the Secretary of Transportation, who I know is well regarded in the field and someone who is regarded as being a pragmatist, I hope that she will ultimately decide to approve that. But I am concerned that there has certainly been some political meddling in that decision. We simply need to encourage everybody to distinguish what we know some Republicans in the House don't like, which is the high-speed rail project, from a project which calls for the upgrading of a railroad that was built under President Abraham Lincoln. pretty significant distinction, and I'm not sure how they conflated Caltrain with high-speed rail, but I can tell you, those of us who have ridden on Caltrain know that it is not
high-speed rail. Right.
Well, and my follow-up was certainly about the electrification of Caltrain, because that is a far less straightforward political situation than a FEMA grant after a flood. Jane, you look like in San Francisco you're sort of trying to figure out similar questions, what has the experience been so far?
Well, you know, a lot of the focus, even here in San Francisco, is on Trump's assault on immigrants, undocumented women, the environment. But actually, the first real victim here in the Bay Area is Caltrain and the modernization electrification project. And it is Caltrain is a very important spine that is driving the engine of the Bay Area and also the rest of this country. In 2004, roughly 24,000 people rode Caltrain. Today, it's 62,000. There was a 161% increase in Caltrain ridership, and this is a good thing. These are 62,000 less cars on the 101 and the 280 impacting greenhouse gas emissions. And for Trump, who actually campaigned on funding infrastructure, this is a very odd victim here in the Bay Area, especially for someone who touts that he wants to strengthen the American economy. Well, a huge engine of the American economy is here in the state of California, and one of those drivers is technology. And Caltrain is part of moving all of these people throughout the region. And if we stop moving people, we will not be able to grow jobs and economy here in the Bay Area. And so electrification will increase service and frequency along the line and while reducing noise and greenhouse gas emissions. This is an incredibly important investment that the federal government was planning to make. Actually, we were really in the last couple of days. I'm exaggerating a bit, but I mean, really in the last 30 days when Trump came into office and derailed this investment. And I think we need to hold the president accountable to his campaign promises. People talk a lot about how this president has held to his campaign promises, and it is true for a number of issues, but it's certainly not been true for infrastructure.
Harmeet, would you say there's still time for him to deliver on?
Sure. I think you have to give him time to look at all of the projects that were crammed through at the end of the Obama administration and evaluate them. And I understand that part of that is what is going on here in Washington. And I certainly support public transportation. And I think that, you know, another one of the tensions here is we've come in California, as the rest of the country, to expect that the federal government will come to the rescue of every project in every state. And that involves money coming out of the pockets of every person in this room and then being filtered through many pockets and many bureaucrats in Washington and then coming back here when we already pay pretty heavy taxes into Sacramento as well. And so I think we ought to be looking more towards our own state and Sacramento for a lot of these state priorities. I don't see why the federal government, even as important as Caltrain is, should be funding a transportation that is within the state of California. So that's a federalism concern.
I just have to point out, though, the vast majority of the Caltrain electrification funding is coming from the region and from the state. It is a very small portion that we're getting from the federal government. In fact, the federal government would not fund Caltrain until we were able to demonstrate that we were able to fund the majority of the project. And that is often how federal government funds infrastructure projects throughout the country that only impact the roads and public transit system of those states and those regions. And it's unfortunate this wasn't a project that was getting crammed through. This is a project that has been over a decade in coming and has been carefully planned for. It's unfortunately taken too long, has not been crammed through the process, and suddenly, as we are in the last step, you know, we get derailed.
Yeah, I might add, too, that, you know, after all, California is a donor state when it comes to tax revenue to the federal government. We do not get every dollar that we contribute. In fact, we get less than $90 for every $100 that we contribute. And you know, it has long been a federal responsibility to invest in major transportation projects throughout this country. You may remember the Federal Highway Program launched under Republican President Eisenhower. This has been a longstanding tradition, and I see no reason why a president who pledges to invest $1 trillion in infrastructure should draw the line here.
Harmeet, okay. Please applause. Thanks.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I wanted to ask you, Harmeet, because we got on the topic of taxation and tax dollars, where they go, where they come from, who's paying more, who's paying less. As someone who helps shape the Republican platform, do you think that the issue of high taxes is a hope for the Republican Party being a bit more popular in the state than it has been? That eventually taxes get to a point where even Californians are mad about paying them?
Well, yes. I mean, that's a complicated issue because those of us here who are taxpayers in California, even if the president follows through, which I very much pray and hope that he does on his promises to cut taxation at the federal level, we are still suffering under a crushing burden of taxation here in California, for which we get diminishing returns in my perception as a taxpayer. And today, Jerry Brown is twisting the arms of every legislator in Sacramento, trying to force them to increase taxes on a one-week emergency basis on roads is his reasoning, but some of us suspect it's the high-speed rail and other pet projects. And, you know, infrastructure is very important, but every day we get pressed to pay for bonds, which is a form of taxation at a very extortionate rate of interest, to do X, Y, or Z, and then somehow the later stages of that in the paperwork or the bond never happen, and then they come back to us for more. So I think taxation is one of the reasons why we're seeing some of the productive younger people California leave the state. We're seeing middle-aged people leave the state, families with children leave the state, leave San Francisco, and it's not healthy. And I think every day Republicans hope that the next time they create an increase in taxes, it's going to lead to citizens questioning, citizens of all political stripes questioning the direction that the state is going, and yet people don't. It's like the frog in the boiling pot, and people just keep staying in the pot until the state economy collapses. That's the way I see it going.
I'm missing all the Californians that are departing the state of California. Every year, the Bay Area is growing. And part of that is because we invest in our infrastructure, which includes our schools, our roads. We don't have businesses, we don't have jobs without investing in that type of infrastructure. And so, you know, taxes is sometimes considered this bad word, but it truly is our investment back into our schools, our community, our state. We don't have an economy without investing in infrastructure. So many businesses depend on our roads and our highways to conduct their businesses. We cannot move goods without roads. Uber doesn't exist without our roads, and that creates jobs. And so I think that it's false to say that taxes hurt businesses. Taxes are actually used to invest in infrastructure that support jobs and employment. Of course, it has to be done the right way, right? And that is one of the most important things that any elected official does, whether they're on the school board, they're in the state legislature, or in Congress, is that they help determine how we invest back our dollars back into our community. And so that is an important discussion. I am very worried about the tax reform debate that's happening in Washington, D.C. today. We are seeing a widening income gap in this country. In fact, San Francisco has the fastest growing income gap in the country. And we have seen over, you know, the last 40 years, for example, CEO compensation grow by almost 1,000%. 997% to be exact. Meanwhile, average worker compensation has gone up by 10% over that same period of time. And so actually tax, you know, as a policy, had a very progressive origin. It was about redistribution of wealth, but also ensuring that we are funding.
It was about the war. It was about World War
One.
Well,
yeah. Well, there was a progressive origin, a movement to taxes, which is about redistribution, but also about making sure that we are investing in infrastructure that gives Americans a fighting chance to enter into the middle class.
Harmeet, you looked a little perplexed over there.
I mean, I'm clearly the only business owner on this panel because it's ludicrous to say that taxation doesn't affect business. And secondly, the statistics are very clear that middle-class people are leaving California. And we live in a little bubble of fantasy here in San Francisco where everybody's either rich or they're homeless and there's very little in between. But the fact is that in the rest of the state, if you go to the places that are one county in and the rest of the state, people are absolutely leaving California because of obscene taxation and inefficient government. And when we pay the taxes, we do not get good roads, we do not get good education, we do not get good services, and we do not get good government. And that's why those folks are taxpayers are in Texas and in Nevada and Florida and other states that are more efficient at addressing the needs of the citizens.
Do you
those
think,
are facts.
I think, I think two things
inconvenient
can be,
facts.
Two things can be equally true. Going back to your question, Brian, I think that if Republicans are successful in getting tax reform over the goal line, that there will be lots of people who will like that, and that will help the Republican Party, I'm sure, because nobody likes paying taxes. At the same time, we talk about the road bill, for example, that's in front of the legislature today. We're talking about a gas tax that hasn't been increased since George Duke Majan was governor, a Republican who increased it, and it hasn't been indexed for inflation. And as a result, we're all paying a hidden tax in potholes and in horrible infrastructure that costs a typical driver in the Bay Area about $800 a year in everything from destroyed tires to substandard gas mileage. We're paying for it whether we want to or not. And so the question really becomes, when you're talking about infrastructure, how are you going to pay? And I'd much rather pay for better infrastructure.
Let me say this right quick. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. We're talking about President Trump's first 100 days. This is the third of a series of programs in partnership with KQED. And our panel today is Sam Liccardo, Mayor of San Jose, Corey Shockey, Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution and Senior Policy Advisor for the McCain-Palin Campaign, Harmeet Dhillon, RNC National Committee Woman for California, among other things, and Jane Kim, San Francisco Supervisor for the 6th District. I'm Brian Watt, Morning News Anchor for KQED. I'm the moderator. You can listen to Commonwealth Club programs on the radio or podcast. Watch full programs on our YouTube channel. Check out the website and follow the Commonwealth Club on Facebook and Twitter. Harmeet, I wanted to ask you, we know you might be, you are under consideration for a role in the Justice Department. The news out of the Justice Department that came out this particular week was about reevaluating the Justice Department's role in local law enforcement. Reviewing all consent decrees, reviewing all technical assistance. I think I read that it's something like 272 recommendations that the Justice Department has made to San Francisco Police Department that they are implementing with monitoring and some assistance from the Justice Department. A lot of them are to address bias in the department. Can I ask you if this becomes a civil rights issue, should the federal government pull back? Should the federal Justice Department pull back from helping a city, as a function of a consent decree, address bias in its police department?
So there's a lot of issues packed into your question. Let me try to unpack it a little bit. What the Department of Justice announced this week, which is something that I've actually discussed with the Attorney General, is a top-to-bottom review of hundreds of consent decrees throughout the United States. And you can think of this in the same bucket as the ongoing supervision by the courts of desegregation. So we had problems. I grew up in a segregated town in rural North Carolina where there was desegregation ordered by the courts. And the problem is that there may be a problem at a point in time in a police department or a school district or even a voting district with gerrymandering. The question is, should the government continue to pay people to monitor that ad infinitum? And that is the question that is under review with the order that you just discussed. And I think it is healthy to review whether all of those consent decrees are still necessary or not. I suspect the answer at the end of the analysis is going to be some of them are necessary and some of them are not. And it isn't as easy as the Justice Department monitoring police departments. What really happens is the Justice Department puts out a request for proposal, and a private law firm, a white shoe law firm, where fat cat people who are the swamp are getting contracts, those are the people who monitor the police departments. People don't know that. But when Baltimore, for example, which is a controversial one right now, is under a consent decree, some K Street law firm is going to get a couple million dollars a year of a contract to do that, and it's going to go on for 10 years or 20 years. I think that's an obscene use of tax resources, and I think it's legitimate to consider whether that needs to go on forever. Where there is a civil rights violation, the Civil Rights Act requires that the government do something about it. And absolutely, where there's a violation and it's current and it's ongoing, the government needs to address it. Where it happened 10 years ago, I question whether a law firm in D.C. needs to be getting a contract to monitor, and the same goes throughout the United States.
Are you seeing this play out?
Actually, I've been following this, and I'm very concerned. Just in the last couple of years, police-community relations has really emerged as one of the big civil rights issues of this time. Not to say it has not been an issue for decades, but certainly I think with the advent of the phone camera and other technology, we are seeing an increased interest in activism around police behavior. And the Department of Justice, you know, under the Obama administration, started working with about 24 local police agencies throughout the country, and interviewing everyone, those in the community, those in the command staff of the local police departments, down to the officers, to really figure out what is the best way to institute better practices for community policing that builds trust and makes our neighborhood safer. Now, in the case of Baltimore, the DOJ did discover a pattern of discrimination that was violating the civil rights of African Americans in Baltimore, and I'm very troubled to hear Sessions talk about putting a hold on that consent decree, one that had been carefully negotiated under Vinita Gupta's time, heading the Civil Rights Division. And so, you know, I'm very curious, especially from your perspective, actually speaking to the Attorney General, what does the Civil Rights Division, what is the vision of the Civil Rights Division under Jeff Sessions? What does that look like? Because on a local level, we are very concerned because the federal government has often played a role in ensuring that localities adhere to the civil rights liberties of all Americans, including the most vulnerable.
Do you want to answer that, Harmony?
Well, I would say that I don't think it's controversial to say that the mandate in the 1957 Civil Rights Act that created the Civil Rights Division in the United States Department of Justice is that that division enforced the United States civil rights laws. That is absolutely Attorney General Sessions' commitment. He believes he's a man of law and order. I think he's shown that. I think that it is a question of whether we should be holding police departments under the thumb of 20-year-old mistakes that were made 20 years ago, and I think it's legitimate to ask that question. And so where there are ongoing current civil rights violations, hate crimes, discrimination, Voting Rights Act violations, I expect to see the Trump administration take action and enforce the law as they have committed to do.
But I just have to say, I mean, what we're talking about, these patterns of discrimination that leading to what the DOJ found to be, you know, undermining the civil rights liberties of African Americans in particular, but also Latinos and LGBT communities, these are current patterns. These aren't from 20 years ago.
Right, the current patterns under President Obama. However, we can't keep 20 or 30-year-old obligations requiring current consent decrees. So that you can keep arguing about it, but what's happening right now is a review of the existing consent decrees. A review is legitimate. You can complain about it if at the end of the review you think that cities are being left off the hook where there are current civil rights violations. You can't say that right now.
I think in our most vulnerable neighborhoods that are experiencing the pattern where their civil rights are being ignored, a review is just more time that their rights are going to continue to get violated. So I think that this is an urgent and pressing issue of today, and it's something that the DOJ has spent many years working on and that we should continue onwards with. This isn't something that we can wait on.
Well, Jane, you're mistaken. The review does not suspend the existing consent decrees. It simply reviews whether they should be ongoing in the future. There's actually no impact whatsoever on those consent decrees that are there in place.
Let me jump in and let the audience know, since you all were participating a little bit, that actually coming up really fast here in just a few minutes, we'll take questions from the audience to the panelists, obviously very smart people. There's a microphone in the back You can already start to line up at it if you would, and we welcome questions from the audience. Obviously, in the spirit of continuing a civil dialogue. Sam and Jane, you both brought up the issue of sanctuary cities earlier. We went through that really quickly, but it doesn't sound like in terms of funding there is a lot at stake. But in the back rooms, are the city managers coming to you and saying, you know, this is a lot of money we could lose. Should we consider tweaking our policies? And when do you bend?
No. Okay. City manager isn't doing that. We may be in a somewhat different situation than San Francisco because we're not a city and county. San Francisco is the only city right. like that in California. You know, from our perspective, first, you know, we don't call ourselves a sanctuary city for the most part because, and we've had the same policies in place for decades, which is we do not have our police department involved in immigration enforcement. We don't have our police department providing information to immigration authorities. We also don't enforce federal securities laws. We don't enforce federal tax laws or federal environmental laws like any other big city department. We've got enough to do just chasing down violent predators. And so that's been our policy for decades. We don't call ourselves a sanctuary city really because, you know, in my view, I think it is misleading to people who are vulnerable in your community, who in my community, more than 80,000 undocumented immigrants, I don't want them believing somehow or another if they just live in a city, then they will be somehow prevented from being deported. Obviously, a federal agent who has a lawful deportation order and can lawfully arrest someone will do so, whether they're in San Francisco or Tulsa, and the city can't do anything to stop that. And so I think we need to be honest with our residents about what the reality is. There is an area of federal preemption here, and that's the way it is. There's not an enormous amount of money at stake for a city like San Jose, but we're not going to change our policy because fundamentally it just makes our residents less safe. If we have a suspicion that a mere call to 911 or informing the police about gang activity down the street or testifying as a witness in court, that coming forward in that way is going to subject you or a member of your family to deportation. And I know that very well because I'm a former criminal prosecutor. And I can tell you I had many, many sexual assault cases, which is predominantly what I prosecuted, that which I relied upon people who were immigrants. I didn't know if they were documented or not. I'm sure many were undocumented who came forward and had the courage to do that. They would not necessarily have done that. And I know this because I've had a lot of conversations with cops about it. They wouldn't do it if they thought it would get their father deported or get them deported. And so we know, and police chiefs throughout the country know this uniformly, that putting local police departments in the position of enforcing immigration laws is more dangerous for urban communities.
Vicad? Yeah.
So the mayor mentioned we're a city and a county, so we are looking at $1.2 billion of federal funding, either that comes directly from Washington, D.C., or as a pass-through through the state of California. You know, that's not chump change. That's nothing to, you know, to sneeze at. It's about 13% of our city's budget. And I broke it down. I mean, the vast majority, $1 billion of that is entitlements, $800 million of which is the Affordable Care Act, health care for our residents. That being said, San Francisco has united around the issue of sanctuary city. We do believe that it's important to hold to our position and also to let all of our residents know that we don't check documentation to provide city services. I think it is scary, actually, that we've seen a vast reduction in calls around, for example, domestic violence in immigrant communities since Trump has been elected, which just demonstrates, I think, you know, the fear that people have about using local police officers to engage in immigration in immigration enforcement, which, by the way, they cannot. I mean, the Supreme Court has made it very clear that this is the sole jurisdiction of the federal government and that local public safety agencies are not involved in the removal process. But there is that concern. We are lucky to be here in San Francisco, though. And I often say this to those that are progressives and are liberals, that we are very lucky here because we are not just a progressive city, we are also a wealthy city. And so we, in many ways, can enact, you know, progressive policies that municipalities can only dream of. One, for example, is one that I got to work on last year, which is to make San Francisco the first city in the nation to make community college free again. And this is important as I talk about investing in infrastructure, because K through 12, you know, in the mid-20th century was viewed as the foundation with which we provide Americans an opportunity to enter into the middle class. And we just know that that no longer is the case. In fact, 70% of jobs in this country by 2020 will require some type of post-secondary degree. And while we wait for the state and the country to follow, we here in San Francisco, we do have the resources to invest in it, universal and free K through 14, and we should go ahead and do that and model these types of policies and show what the outcomes of that is for the rest of the country.
All right, I want to go to the mic in the back of the room, make sure that some audience members get to ask some questions.
Hi.
Hi.
Earlier in the conversation, Supervisor Kim made a comment about people becoming more interested in government and having there being a growth in government 101. And my statement, I guess, is that the president himself is enrolled in government 101 right now. And I'm concerned, personally, that he's going to make some kind of on-the-job training mistake. And are there appropriate checks and balances in place that something's not going to be tweeted or said off the cuff that's going to get us involved in another world war, for example?
Corey Shockey, yeah.
So I share your concern that the way that the president tweets about foreign and defense policy and a lot of his statements drive up the cost to the United States of preserving a liberal international order that is manifestly in our interests and the interests of most other states in the international order. But I think you're dramatically underestimating the importance of checks and balances and just how rigorous they are. You know, as I think we have seen in the first 100 days, right, that the courts have been extraordinarily active in asserting their right. And I think one of the prices that President Trump is going to pay for some of the early executive orders and not seeking sufficient legal counsel on those executive orders is he's not going to get the benefit of the doubt from the court on a lot of things that he might want to do that have to do with national security, like managing immigration, taking refugees, and border control issues. On war and peace, you know, there has been a sliding responsibility from the Congress to the president for about the last 50 years. A willingness on the part of the Congress to go to war without taking a vote. It's actually disgraceful that we are fighting in Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, Somalia, and other places under an authorization for the use of military force that was not designed for them. So the checks and balances are in place. Congress actually needs to step up and do the job all of us send them there, which is play a role in not just funding military operations and foreign policy, but in providing presidential oversight, which they have done much, much too little of in the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another question.
Sure. This is a question for Harmeet. Two-part question. One, do you acknowledge the incompetence of the current Trump administration? There are so many data points. Firing your national security advisor within 60 days, failing to appeal Obamacare, basically failing on your Muslim ban, etc. So the question is, do you acknowledge it, one? And two, what assurance do we have that he will not be as incompetent in the next 80 days and 4 years?
Yeah, I'm not going to answer that type of tendentious argument. You gave a little speech there. That wasn't a real question.
It's a real question. Do you acknowledge it?
I acknowledge you asked a tendentious, self-serving question.
All right. Harmeet has answered that question. And so there's another one.
First, I want to thank the panel. I appreciate you guys coming out here, and it's nice to have diversity of views up there and listen to this discussion. I've learned a lot. I actually was a little bit surprised. One of the statements that came up when you guys were discussing was about an exodus from California due to our tax policies or other various policies, and that kind of surprised me. I felt like I wasn't ready to, you know, mentally I hadn't thought of that. So I you know, figured out, oh, I should probably look this up, so I quickly pull it up on my phone, the census information and all, and it seems like our population growth is really high, so that couldn't be it. So I looked up, and I'll keep it brief, I looked up the net interstate, and it is negative, but by a fraction of 0.01%. So what I'd like to know is sort of, where is this massive exodus of people leaving California? Because I'm worried about it. I'm even more worried that I don't see any evidence of it. But I'd like to know what we are doing in California and where these people are going. So thank you.
I think you brought up the exodus.
Yeah, so. I said that because the evidence is that many people who are taxpayers, middle-class people, have left the state to seek better environments, jobs, better tax environments in other states. And yes, there are people coming into the state. For one thing, there are lots of people who are undocumented coming into the state because it is a haven, and now it is actually officially a sanctuary state. And then secondly, there are it continues to be an attractive place, particularly San Francisco. We do live in a bubble here where, you know, in my neighborhood, the rents of two-bedroom apartments are $6,000 and $7,000, and people are getting paid high salaries, and they can come in here and live. But when those young tech dudes and bros have to start getting married and have families and then have to buy housing here and send their kids to the awful schools in San Francisco, that's when they get up and leave. So the dynamic is that.
I just have to say a couple of things here. One, it is true San Francisco does have a declining middle class, and I want to agree with Harmeet on that. The middle class in San Francisco in 1970 made up 45% of our population. It's now declined to 34%. And mirroring, actually, the rest of the country, where the middle class in 1970 used to outnumber the low-income and upper-income communities, San Francisco very similarly is seeing a growing income gap. And now our low-income and upper-income communities, those that make under $25,000 a year and those that make above $100,000 a year, that population is going up. But in most of the surveys that I see in the Bay Area, and I'm not speaking for the state of California, it's not taxes that are driving people out of San Francisco. It is the cost of housing that is pushing people out of San Francisco. And that is why I went back to the point of, well, what does the federal government do around issues that we care about on a daily basis? And one of that is, of course, the issue of housing. There was a time when the federal government made a very strong investment in the creation of affordable and public housing, and I supported that. In fact, it's interesting, you talk to social counselors from the 1960s and 70s, and there used to be a time when there were more public housing units online than there were people on the wait list. And when people became homeless, we used to house people in a few days, in a matter of days, maybe weeks. Now we have families who are the fastest growing segment of our homeless count. Families, single mothers with children, the fastest segment of our working mothers with children. They're the fastest segment of our homeless count, and we don't have housing to put them in, and that is a shame, and that is a moral dilemma, not just for our cities, but for our country as well.
Sam?
Just regarding the demographic flows, you know, Department of Homeland Security syndicated the data shows since 2009, we've actually had a net zero immigration into the country of undocumented immigrants. President Obama, under 8 years of governance, deported about 3 million undocumented immigrants, roughly equivalent to the number that came into the country during that time. So there has not been a net inflow of undocumented immigrants. What we know in the city of San Jose, took a close look at the demographics. We're going to add about 400,000 people over the next quarter century. And that's really a lot of people. And believe me, I've got a lot of residents who would love to build a wall around the city, keep them all out, except for the fact that we found out about 2/3 of them are going to be their children or grandchildren. So even if you don't like your kids very much, you can't kick them out. So we really need to talk about growth as a reality. And that means, yes, we've got to be focused on how we build housing more densely in urban cores, and hopefully with help from the federal government, transit dollars that will help people move around.
One more question from back there.
Another question for Jane Kim regarding the statement on the benefits of California tax policy. I believe California ranks 40th in education quality and worst worse than 40th in infrastructure quality, and we are among the top five states in terms of tax burden. And I'd like to know the logic behind why our tax policy is that great.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't want to, I was not arguing that our tax policies are great. I said that taxes are important as an investment back into our communities. We are actually 48th in the country in per pupil spending, and that is dismal. We are the seventh largest economy in the world, and we invest less in our human capital than, you know, 47 other states in the country. And that actually largely has to do with flawed tax policy, most notably Prop 13, after which, you know, slowly over the last 30 years, we've seen schools lose a third of the funding that they used to have. We used to have the best public schools in the country. In fact, 30 years ago, if you went to UC Berkeley, we subsidized 78% of your tuition. Today, we subsidize 37%. Same with CSU. We subsidize 81% of your tuition. Today, we subsidize at about 56%. Prop 13 has had an immense detrimental effect because property taxes is largely how we pay for our schools. And what we are seeing, actually, is in particular that commercial properties that used to be a larger part of our tax base and paying for our schools is shrinking in their investment in our schools because of Proposition 13. And that's why the conversation around split rolling is incredibly important. I was not defending the overall tax policies of the state of California. I was just saying that I'm concerned about the income tax reforms that the Trump administration is proffering, given the exacerbated income and wealth gap that we're seeing here in this country. It just feels like it's a move in the opposite direction of what we want to be moving in. And when we talk about, and when Trump talked about supporting the working class, well, one of the ways of doing that is, of course, in investing in education, because the jobs that we are creating for tomorrow are not what our working class residents are being trained for today. And so this country has to pivot. And my hope is that the Trump administration will really be a part of a solution for bolstering and increasing our middle class here in the country, the opposite of the direction that has happened both under Republican and Democratic presidencies here in this nation.
Thanks, audience, for some really great questions. I have one last question, bold, brief. So President Trump was elected because a lot of people wanted something very different from what we've been seeing in Washington. Each of you, what would you do differently? You might be going to Washington. You worked in Washington. So we all have different ways of looking either towards or back at Washington. What would you change? What would you change about the way things get done in Washington?
Like one of the things that President Trump said, and I've referred to it before, it's about draining the swamp. And I think that way too much of our governments, whether it be Sacramento, whether it be San Francisco, with all due respect to current company, or whether it be Washington, D.C., is controlled by sleazy middlemen who are greasing the wheels of government for the benefit of their private, wealthy business interests, landowners, industries, foreign governments, what have you. And so if that were the one thing that I could change and they remove that ugly class of people who trade on influence peddling in our governments, and there was more of a direct relationship between the citizens and the servants who are elected to serve the citizens, and they remembered that they were the servants of the citizens and not ends in and of themselves and industries in and of themselves to keep themselves in office and get termed out and run for something else and something else and something else. That's what I would like to see more in our government.
Okay. Bold brief, Jane Kim.
First of all, I just want to say, just because, you know, we had this discussion about the Civil Rights Division, I do want to really respect Hermit's work around advocating for the civil rights liberties of the Sikh community, both here in this community and nationally. That work is incredibly important, and I think is a huge part of what, you know, I embrace as an American value. I do just have to add, just because it's a fact, that Department of Justice is asking a judge to pause the consent decree in Baltimore, despite the protest of the Baltimore Police Commissioner and mayor and community leaders. So it's not just a review. There are reviews of other consent decrees, but there is actually also pause of implementation occurring. In terms of what we're seeing in D.C. today, I think we can all agree that we want to see more bipartisan work from Democrats and Republicans. And many of the issues that, you know, I have brought up as huge national issues, you know, both the Republican and Democratic Party has failed. And when I bring up the statistic that CEO compensation has risen by 997% since 1970, at the same time, worker compensation has only grown by 10%, it is understandable why many Americans wanted a change and why for some they felt that Trump represented that. And I don't think it's an unfair criticism of Clinton and many members of the Democratic Party that they often don't hold Wall Street accountable for their impact on the growing income and wealth gap in the country. And the Democrats are going to really have to come up with a response. And that is what I'm hoping for, you know, over the next couple of years, is that both parties really figure out, you know, instead of giving lip service to the working and middle class of America, actually start developing policies that benefit those communities. Again, by investing in infrastructure, investing in public education. And that is really what is going to make America great again.
The biggest...
All right. Thanks.
The biggest national security vulnerability our country has is that we are spending money we don't have. We have absolutely got to stop racking up national debt, because if the interest rate rises, we are going to completely crowd out discretionary spending for all of the kinds of things that the mayor and supervisor were advocating for their communities. We must have security and solvency. As President Eisenhower said, your government owes you both of those things, and we are not practicing them properly. I hope all of you will walk out of here pitchforks and torches to be debt hawks and tell your representatives that our country has seldom been safer, seldom been more prosperous, seldom had greater advantages than we have now. And we are spending ourselves into an enormous hole that our children will have to dig us out of.
Mm. Yeah, I think we should put away the pitchforks and torches for a while. You know, people are really tired of the partisanship. They're tired of the fighting. You know, when Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, he'd take Republican members out for dinner, and they'd hash it out. That doesn't happen because, you know, and I hear this time and time again from legislators in D.C. and in Sacramento when I'm up there, they don't talk to one another anymore. There is very little collaboration. There's very little willingness for people to take risks to buck their party or their particular interest group. And we need to get back to civil discourse again. And it starts at the top, but I think it's a role we can all play.
All right. Well
said. A big thanks to our panelists, and let me ask the audience to allow the panel to get off the stage and out of the room before you all start moving and clapping. Please. No, this was housekeeping ask that I was asked to make, but... Thanks very much, Sam Liccardo, Mayor of San Jose, Corey Shockey of the Hoover Institution, Supervisor Jane Kim, and Harmeet Dhillon. Thanks so much for joining us. Everybody, have a good night.